Hi, this is Jeannie Gillespie, and I'm your host for New Books in Popular Culture. Recently, I spoke with Mark McHarry and Paul Malone about the new book, Boys Love Manga, Essays on the Sexual Ambiguity and Cross-Cultural Fandom of the Genre. McHarry met with his co-editors, Tony Levy and Drew Pagliasotti, at YaoiCon, and they pulled together this fascinating collection of essays by scholars, producers of manga, and also consumers. Malone comes to us from the University of Waterloo, and he's contributed an essay to the collection on manga and its reception and economic power in Germany. Hi, Mark. Hi, Paul.
Yeah, hi. Hello.
Hey, glad we're working this out with three-way conversation. So, Mark, I'm going to let you start and tell us a little bit about your background and about how the collection of essays came together.
Sure. I'm an independent scholar, and I'm interested very much in Japanese popular culture. So I was at a fan event called YaoiCon in Northern California back in 06, I think, yeah. And I ran into a professor from Portland State, Antonio Levy, who had published a book on samurai soldiers, a book on contemporary anime and manga. And, you know, we hit it off. And the following year, we were both there at the next YaoiCon in 07, and we met Drew Pagliasotti. And so the three of us at that con sat down together at a table, and we were chatting, and I suggested, you know, hey, let's do a book. So, you know, we obviously had to do some research to see if this would fly with publishers. And that takes a while. Books, you know, books are a terribly long process, but here we are. I can tell you a little bit about what the book is. It's a collection of scholarly essays on boys love manga, just as it sounds. It's focused on how it is received in the West, or rather outside Japan, I should say. So it's not on Japanese content. You know, it's not on manga and anime about boys love in Japan, but more about their the products that are, you know, that have that genre, that flavor in other regions. So there's 14 essays plus an introduction, has a bibliography, and it's indexed. And we dedicated the book to Yonezawa Yoshihiro. Yonezawa-san is the co-founder of the comic market, which started in Tokyo back in the early 70s, mid-70s. And it's become a huge event, and it's become the cradle, the birthplace, really, for the growth of boys love manga in Japan. So, you know, we wanted to kind of recognize that. So that's the book.
And you're here with one of your collaborators, correct?
Yes, yes. Paul Malone has considered a chapter, a very in-depth look at boys love manga in Germany. Paul, do you want to say a little bit about your essay?
I can. I mean, first of all, I should say I'm a My field is German literature and then German cultural history, German film. So I'm a complete outsider both to Asian studies and certainly to those that overlap queer studies on the boys love manga. I don't belong in that bag either. But manga is tremendously popular in Germany, and boys love manga is one of the most, I'm using this term, quite deliberately, passionately embraced manifestations of manga, not just in Japan, but elsewhere. And it really motivates fans to become producers, and in the case of Germany, not only producers, but publishers. And that to me, is incredibly interesting in a country where comic book culture is not as established as it is, certainly not in Japan, but also not by North American standards.
Great, thanks. Before we get further into Paul's essay, I think maybe we could talk a little bit about what boys love manga is, what the rage is, because I also consulted my expert group of teenage girls here in Mississippi, and they're quite fascinated by it as well. So maybe you could give us a little bit more background, Mark, on the subgenre itself.
Yeah, sure. It It started off in Japan, obviously in the late, about the late 1960s, in the wake of the beginning of the manga boom of Japan that would later become just, you know, huge. And it there were women who were working at manga publishers, and, you know, they wanted to do something a bit different, and they would draw stuff on the side, and they would just do it on, you know, for their own benefits. And at some point, you know, one of them went to a publisher and said, you know, how about it? One of the two manga that are considered among the foundational manga for boys' love, Toma no Shinjo by Moto Hagio, was published in 1974. And then another one by her roommate, they were, you know, living together at the time, they shared a flat, is Kazutoki Iwuta, Song or Poem of Wind and Tree. The first title would be translated something like Thomas's Heart. And they're both about young adolescents, boys in boarding schools, one in France, the other in Germany, and about what happens to them there. And they're both very long, they're, you know, epic kinds of works, and they were incredibly popular. They were best-selling works on publication, although the Kazutoki Iwuta was delayed because of it shows very frank depictions of male eroticism, so there was some delay before it could get published. And they're still in print, and they've been published in several editions since. So you know, it's just grown from that. Women in Japan who typically do boys love manga will start off as amateurs, but at some point they may become professional. But they will continue to draw their own manga, called doshinshi, a fan-produced manga. They'll still do that on the side, and they'll sell that, and that's what they'll sell at the comic market.
And that's fascinating, because I think, Paul, what you're looking at, the idea of that translating to a German audience. So I wonder if you could build on what's happened to the manga as it becomes integrated in the German economy.
Well, there are similarities between the German situation and other Western comics industry situations, and there are differences. The major difference is the fact that compared to the U.S., I'm Canadian, so I'll often speak of the U.S. or America as the other as well, but rather, you know, I'm also a North American, but I'm not an American. But the two other major comics producing countries are, of course, the U.S. and France. And in those countries, comics culture, at least once, arguably could be called a genuine mass medium, rather than a niche medium.
Mm-hmm.
That's never been the case in Germany, where Germany has always treated comics very much as a niche and a very much disreputable niche, suitable only for children, and you should keep your kids away from it too, frankly. Much like the attitude in the 1950s in the U.S., I mean, that's always been the prevailing cultural attitude in Germany. And it's left German comics fans, who certainly exist, and German comics publishers, feeling a bit besieged. The arrival of manga, here we come to some of the similarities, in Germany, just as in the U.S. or in France, suddenly meant the import of a kind of fresh to westernized aesthetic, a different kind of psychological basis for storytelling that seemed unpredictable to Westerners, and most importantly, from a sort of demographic capitalist basis, it appealed to a much broader demographic, both in terms of age and in terms of gender. And in the U.S., France, and Germany, mainstream comics, certainly since the mid-1970s, early 1980s, had increasingly become a boys' club. You know, superhero comics in the U.S.,
sure.
Adventure comics in Europe, really speak to overwhelmingly to a male audience. And the niches that had once catered to, you know, female readers, romance comics, things like that, and to younger readers of any gender, funny animal comics, had pretty much died out. So manga meant a reintroduction of a huge range of styles and genres that appealed to female readers of all ages and appealed to readers who were under 14. And that, of course, for a relatively marginalized industry like the German industry, that made a huge demographic difference in the appeal that they could then advertise.
Sure, I think that's fascinating. I think also the whole comic genre for females also fascinates me. And I wonder, Mark, if you could talk a little bit more about the popularity in Japan and then how that's translated, and again, as Paul was saying, through all different age groups and also really across the world.
In the U.S., there were a couple events that that I think was responsible for the growth of what's called yaoi here, Yamanashi, Ochinashi, Minashi, for an ironic acronym for no climax, no point, no meaning. It's a word used in Japanese. The Japanese typically refer to a voice of manga as beru manga, adopting the English loan words, those characters are foreign to Japanese. But here we do the opposite. We take a Japanese word for it. But what happened there was an anime called Gundam Wing that aired on the Cartoon Network in the late 90s. And at the same time, obviously, the web was, starting its trajectory to, where it is now. Sort of an all-pervasive kind of medium that it's become. It gave a platform to these young girls that Paul just mentioned, who, in their bedrooms, in their homes, could create works. They could draw, they could, more here in the U.S., more commonly they write, and they could upload it without any editorial control, without any parental or educational school supervision. They were doing what they wanted to do. They had the freedom now to do it. And they saw this anime and they said, imagine the possibilities. And it just took off. So what they did was they, wrote, fan fiction stories, about, the characters of this anime, involved in homoerotic situations, which incidentally was not at all unrecognized by the establishment in Japan. The commercial publisher who owns the right, Sunrise, to these characters, of this particular product, Gundam Wing, produced a phone card, a telephone card with NTT, Nippon Telegraph and Telephone. Wow. They produced a phone card with the illustration showing two of the characters, Duo Maxwell and Hiro Yoi, in an embrace,
wow.
A very kind of defiant, proud embrace. And they did this for their fans. This was this phone card was published in a magazine called Animage, which is still a very major magazine. It's the major magazine in Japanese for anime and manga. And, that's just, the owners of Tintin in France, the owners here wouldn't do that. Although we have seen superheroes who are gay, that's certainly now part of the landscape for comics in the U.S. And I don't know much about comics in the U.S., so I apologize. But, there is that. But they still really are very distinct genres. They come from very distinct places, and they've maintained their, their sort of separateness as comic genres. Maybe Paul can speak to that better than I can. But I don't know, Paul. Are you seeing a blend at all, or is it really kind of separate?
It's very difficult, partly because the mainstream comics in the U.S. are so corporate controlled, and
sure.
Moreover, most of the mainstream. I mean, the big two. Marvel and DC, the home of the American superheroes, are wings of multimedia conglomerates, and basically Marvel is now owned by Disney, just a few months ago, really, and DC, of course, home of Superman and Batman, has been owned by Warner Communications for decades now. They've really been kind of almost relegated to a kind of cheap research and development section where movie properties can be tried out and the rights to longstanding characters can be maintained fairly cheaply for future development in other media. It works very much against innovation of any real kind. It tends to a kind of conservative stasis for the most part. We have seen some gay characters come in. I don't really follow American comics very closely, but my daughters are starting to read them, and so that's been my entry point back into them. But the gay characters are still pretty much marginalized. They have to remain celibate in a way that heterosexual characters don't. They have a tend to have a higher death rate than heterosexual characters. You know, they're the ones who will sacrifice themselves for the team first, often. And I've had, there are a couple of instances that seem to be coming up now where they're trying to take a more of a kind of natural viewpoint. It's like, oh, these, you know, these are characters who just happen to be gay rather than gay characters.
Mm-hmm.
Some people may regard that as progress, and some may actually regard that as kind of regression. It's like, why you're making their homosexuality unimportant in a regressive way, in a way that's like, well, we won't talk about their being homosexual, and they'll kick butt like the other characters, and no one will care. So I think it's still very, very different from what we find with the treatment of homosexuality or homoeroticism, homoerotic attraction, depending on how explicit the work is, that we find in boys' love manga. And there, too, of course, because this is produced largely by straight women for straight women, there's a problematic aspect of that as well. But it's a very, very different situation.
I wonder if we could expand on that, too, that it's produced for women and by women. And, Mark, I know that you deal with that a little bit in your essay, talking about the feminine discourse of sexuality and why that's so passionately embraced. If we go back to Paul's introduction, what keeps the interest? What there is going on, do you think, that makes it so popular, so fascinating?
You know, that's the $64 million question, or whatever the figure is nowadays. you know, freedom. You know, I did an informal survey at one YaoiCon, and I asked about 12 women in a row. You know, why do you do this? And, you know, one said, you know, oh, this is our pornography. And, you know, two interviews later, another one said, now, Mark, I want you to know this is not pornography. You know, okay. The only common denominator was fun. They do it because it's fun. And so what I would read into that, if I, you know, could do that, if I'm permitted to do it, would be, you know, it's a chance at freedom. It's a chance for control and autonomy. You know, at expressing their own, you know, interests, their own emotions, you know, their own erotic desires. You know, that's as far as I can see, you know, for it. But it is very popular among women. There are about 20% of the attendees at the YaoiCon are male. You know, I'm going to make a guess, 5%, maybe a little more, are there because they're the boyfriends of the women and they're just tagging along. But the others are gay, identified in one way, shape, or form. But there again, if you ask them, and there's been on the, there's a thing called the YaoiCon Forum, it's a bulletin board, and, you know, there are people who post questions, you know, why, you know, what is your sexual orientation? And the answers will be, my sexual orientation is, you know, I don't know. Or my sexual orientation is trisexual, T-R-Y, I will try. You know, so, you know, they don't want to be pigeonholed. It's one thing Kinsey said in the Kinsey's report on sexuality in the human male back in whatever it was, 48 or something. He said you can't force facts into pigeonholes. And the sooner we understand, the sooner we understand that, the sooner we will understand the realities of sex. And, yeah, I think there's, you know, you can't, it's also a very non-political genre. You won't, you know, people will not take up, you know, you don't see a lot of discussion of homophobia in it. And to, you know, kind of come back or allude to what you said earlier, Gene, that it's, you know, they're doing it because they want to show these relationships and they want to explore them and, you know, consider issues, you know, that are not necessarily, you know, gay issues. And so there are certainly some gay men, a number of them are gay males, who are opposed to the genre, opposed to yaoi here in the States, and opposed to boys love in Japan, Japanese males. Because of this, it's not realistic. I asked a Taksan, he owns Taksan, it's a gay bar in the Shinjuku, Nichome, and I asked Taksan, and he said, no, this is, you know, this doesn't show my life. This doesn't show the life of the men I know. You know, he is concerned with, you know, a gay life in Japan and having a community and to the extent that they can, and, you know, helping and communicating with people and doing all kinds of cool things from a gay activist standpoint. But, you know, he does not see any of that reflected in Japanese boys' love. And I think it's fair to say you see very little, if any, but, well, probably some, but I mean very little reflected in the U.S. too.
That's interesting. I'd like to talk a little bit more about reception in the East and reception in the West, and why perhaps there has been a historical fetishization of the East as an erotic source. And it's interesting that coming from the East, it comes in a very different discourse. It seems much more open, much freer, much more accessible for a variety of interpretations. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about the Japanese-ness of the source of this proliferation across the markets and across the internet. I know you talked about the internet a little bit, but also possibly what's Japanese about it.
Well, that's, you know, that it gets into. I mean, one thing I intend to do, I'm hoping to do, is you know, read some more on post-colonial theory to delve into it that way. But it is kind of a fetish object in a sense, you know, in a broad use of the term. You know, people here, you know, tend to exoticize, you know, they make exotic things that they don't understand, and they don't have the quotidian day-to-day, you know, reality of living there and having to deal with the culture. So it's, you know, it becomes, you know, the grass is greener, you know, grass is always greener, whatever the cliche is. There is some of that to it for all kinds of reasons, you know, that have to do with commodity flows and stuff. But, you know, yeah, I don't know. It's there is that. On the other hand, I will say fans who are, you know, fans progressing along and really getting into the genre, like, many fans in many different areas of life, you know, want to really understand it better, and they'll make an effort. You'll have, you know, yaoi fans learning Japanese. You'll have yaoi fans, you know, who are in college doing the best they can to get over there for a year and live. You know, so they do try to come to a more sophisticated understanding of, you know, what the cultural differences and similarities may be. And I think there is that, you know, that is a, that's kind of a very valued thing. I mean, you know, fandom has status, right? And the high status fans are the ones who are able to do that, to do things like that. You know, like anything else, you really want to, if you really enjoy it, you want to know more about it.
And be participant in it as well. One of the essays deals with Indonesia as a very traditional, very conservative culture, but there's a huge explosion of fandom. Do you see that in other countries as well?
Well, it's certainly, you know, the one continent I know outside the U.S. fairly well, because I've lived there for a long time, is Latin America. You know, I've talked to people who are editors at manga publishing companies in Mexico City. I've talked to Doshinshi, Boys Love Doshinshi women in Santiago, Chile, and in Lima, Peru. And you know, yeah, you know, it's prevalent, I would say. You don't have the commercial product, the manga, the Boys Love manga that is brought in and licensed by publishers in the West into English, which is prevalent here in the U.S. and available in Europe, at least in major cities, in some major cities in Europe, like one that bookstores I've been to in Stockholm and Paris. But so you don't have that, you know, that's scarce in a place like Santiago, Chile. But, you know, the internet is there, and, you know, so there's a lot of activity there. It, you know, when I've looked on domain, you know, I've done Google searches for domains, you know, like .ru for Russia, and I find it pretty much everywhere, not so much in Saudi, in the Mideast, like Saudi Arabia. Mm-hmm. I haven't found it there. Doesn't mean it's not happening, though, by any means. It just means it's not, it's not up to the level of Google's radar for that. And Africa, that I don't know. I would expect in, you know, the wealthier regions of Africa, South Africa, certainly, it would be popular among women.
Okay, so maybe we could talk a little bit about some of the thematic issues. Certainly, the Paul talks a little bit about where manga came from into Germany, but then what has happened to it in Germany. And also throughout the book, people are talking about different kinds of representation of other and of self in the manga, the idea of switching bodies and switching characters, or switching genders, a character changing, and the sort of, what do I want to call that, happenstance or coincidence, the story about the ring and putting the ring on the finger, and then all of a sudden, and I apologize for not knowing more about these actual pieces, but I was fascinated by I wrote it down.
But only the ring finger knows?
Only the ring finger knows, yes, that's it. Only the ring finger knows. I wonder if you could talk about some of the themes and some of the ideas that are coming across in the various versions of Boys Love Manga.
Yeah, well, that's an article in our book by Neil Akatsuka. You know, most of the authors were, professors or maybe a third of them graduate students. But Neil is an undergraduate student, was an undergraduate student. He's now in graduate school. And he wrote about homophobia, and it was one of his themes, and the fact that this genre is, I'm loping yaoi and boys love together as one genre, is almost resolutely neutral. It's not here nor there. It's not, any one thing or another. It's too diverse a genre. There's too many works that have been published on the internet and in print, to rope it in like that. But, it does allow, because it doesn't affirm, the genre does not affirm specifically that, something like homophobia is a bad thing, which in a queer context would be something that you would think would be kind of a given. It is open to charges of being homophobic, or at least of tolerating homophobia. That's an issue. I think that's something that, it is what it is. And, it doesn't serve the purpose of, the gay community, to what extent there is a gay community, in its battle against prejudice and stuff like that. That was one, yeah. I mean, because it's a collection with these, 14 essays, they're all over the map in terms of, interest. I mean, I was amazed at, what Paul found about what he reported in terms of the manga industry in Germany and, where things were going. There's other essays that, as you pointed out, about Indonesia. And there's personal essays too, including one by a man and a woman, one of them in the UK, the guy and the woman in Australia, about their own very personal, encountering the genre and how it affected them, kind of a thing. So it's really, all over the map that way. One thing I would say is a theme that would be worthy of discussion is censorship and what the literal definition being a government prohibition of speech, not just the corporate self-censoring, although that certainly follows from it. And that's an issue. It's an issue in Indonesia, as Yamila Abraham pointed out in her article.
Right.
And it's an issue in the U.S., where there's a man in prison for, for possessing, ordering, receiving, and possessing manga that's considered obscene. And in Japan, the governor of Tokyo, Ishihara-san, has condemned homosexuality and condemned manga separately. The governor of Tokyo Prefecture, I guess he doesn't like boys love, although I don't know what he said on it. So there's efforts in Osaka and some other places to restrict the sale of manga to young children and to, kind of regulate it more closely. And historically in Japan, manga has been a very unregulated thing. Very unregulated. And the latest effort is Ishihara-san's in Tokyo to restrict manga to sales to youth, and that's caused the publishers to just rise up in almost, a revolt. They've set up, they've announced that they're not going to attend a government-sponsored fair for manga, and they're going to have their own alternative fair, and, display their manga there, which is a big deal. I mean, publishers like Kodansha and other, household name publishing companies because of that, you know, restriction. So yeah, that's you know, that's a big one, big issue too.
Sure, Paul, are you seeing similar things in Germany?
Well, Germany also has very, very restrictive laws against not only child pornography, but there's also in the last couple of years, and these tend to be European Union mandated laws nowadays, so that they're uniform throughout Western Europe. There's not only child pornography, there's also a separate category called youth pornography, which includes a slightly older age range who cannot be depicted in explicit sexual situations. So it's interesting. Pornography and prostitution are legal in Germany to a degree that they are neither legal nor respectable in many other Western countries. But child pornography and now youth pornography are extremely closely defined, and certainly something that both the government and publishers obviously have to keep a close eye on what can and can't be published. The interesting thing about indigenous German-produced manga produced by German artists is obviously you don't have to worry about censoring something that was made for a different audience with different legal standards.
So imported things have a different reception.
I mean, imported things you have to look at and go, can we bring this in? Mm-hmm. Whereas indigenous stuff, you go, look, here are the laws we have to conform to, so, you know, we're not going to show this. That's just not on the table.
You can
see that as an advantage or a disadvantage, but obviously it's a different situation from importing material authority made for different audience.
Sure.
The genre is all over the map. So there are works that are as explicit as any, you know, gay male pornography might be. There's also a lot of works that are not at all. You know, they're erotic, but they're you know, they're not explicit in the sense of violating, you know, U.S. or other laws. So it's just, you know, in Japan and the U.S., it's just all kinds of stuff. So my guess is if there were some kind of censorship that would prohibit, you know, effectively prohibit very explicit voice love, which would be difficult to do given the Internet, but hypothetically, if it were true, you know, people are, you know, still are very much, you know, liking, you know, interested in and producing and consuming, you know, the less direct, less sexually explicit works too.
And it's also, we use the term boys love as a genre, and even in the subtitle of the book. But boys love also intersects and overlaps with all kinds of other genres, like manga in general does. So that, boys love elements ranging from implicit and subtle to all-out explicit can be found in stories that could also be classified as horror, Western, historical, comedy, gritty police drama, or romantic fantasy with elves and things like that. There, too, it's all over the map in a different sense.
With one notable exception, I once signed up to do a paper on, you know, vampire, yaoi vampire, and I found a hard time finding Japanese examples of that.
Oh, that's interesting. I wonder if that's
you might find more of it in the West than in Japan, actually.
No, that's great. Yeah, no, that I was kind of going to go there and look at other types of fantasy characters and their use in erotic settings, and certainly the vampires. I was at the Popular Culture Association meeting in San Antonio, and the vampire panels were fascinating because there was sort of a similar dynamic of creating what you wanted to see. It was fascinating, and looking at some of the manga and the anime that I know are things that my children have looked at, but still there's an element of dressing up, boys dressing up as girls or girls dressing up as boys, and playing games with what a Western gaze would call boys' roles and girls' roles. And I wondered if there was, there's a lot more ambiguity, I guess. And sometimes you can't even tell if the character is really female or male, and it doesn't really seem to matter to the story either. And I wondered, go ahead.
You could probably argue that Anne Rice was doing boys'
exactly.
love long before manga ever were known in the West.
There you go. Right, of course. So how does that play into the academic discourse?
I can start by talking about Japanese culture. The little I know of it is that, there is a lot of ambiguity. I mean, you can go back to the Heian era, back to the 10th century, 11th centuries, and find written works that talk about, there's one story called The Changelings that mm-hmm. Gregory Flugfelder wrote about in an article, I think in his book, that talks about how these brothers and sisters exchanged, sex roles. And then for a while, then they switch back again. That has been a theme that's been prevalent, I guess, present in Japanese culture since the beginnings of the Japanese language, almost. And so today you have the Takarazuka theater, which is a women's only, all-female theater troupe that's hugely popular, staging plays about popular manga like The Rose of Versailles, or, sailors in Great Britain in the 1800s on the high seas. And the audience for this are women. And, there's a huge fan base for the Takarazuka in Japan. As you said, Gene, a lot of characters, it's sometimes hard to tell, especially to Western eyes, what their sex might be. You have, fairly sex-ambiguous people in product advertisements. Mm-hmm. You'll see this on billboards and just walking around Tokyo. You've got Visual K bands, boys bands, who dress up in women's clothing and, are very popular too. So these are, that's been part of the culture for a long time. Paul mentioned earlier queer theory, I think there's a lot that queer theory, that's where I'm coming from theoretically in the genre is looking at it from a queer theoretical approach. I think there's a lot of it there. It's just resistance. It's a resistance to norms. It's a resistance to rigid roles. It's a resistance to the notion of having two sexes. Sometimes it is of having mm-hmm. two sexes at all.
Paul, anything to add there?
Just that there's also a kind of downside to that in that from the point of view of sort of Orientalism and mm-hmm. the colonial past, is there's a long tradition, obviously, of seeing the non-European, and particularly East Asian non-European, as effeminate in a negative sense. And a lot of that attitude still holds over, and some of this material, I think, can resonate with those attitudes as well, and in a way that the consumer may not be directly aware of, because those attitudes are sort of deep in our culture. So there are elements of freedom and rebellion in it, definitely, but they can also resonate with less positive, constrictive ideas. But that's true, I think, of most. Certainly popular cultural artifacts and many high cultural artifacts as well.
Sure, that makes sense, yeah.
Yeah, and then I would layer that with some racialization as well. Mm-hmm. Since so much of manga characters appear to Western eyes to be white, that's not how they appear necessarily to a Japanese person. But on the other hand, the studies of Japanese popular culture in general, I've shown that there are some stunning, what I would personally consider in the U.S. to be stunning examples of racism, expressed in product advertising and things like that. And there hasn't been, unfortunately, not yet anyway. I'm hoping that there will be, work in that area too.
But at the same time, it's interesting, particularly in that light, how often in boys' love materials, in Japanese boys' love materials, the material is distanced, alienated in a way by deliberately being set in the West, or by having one of the characters be a Westerner quite explicitly, so that this homoeroticism is kind of displaced in a way that you could argue makes it a bit easier to take. Well, it's not happening here in our backyard. And some Western boys' love then reciprocates by deliberately setting it in Japan, or anywhere but here.
Mm-hmm.
Or in a historical materials anywhere but now, where there's a kind of cushioning effect, I think, where it's like, well, regardless of whether you find this sexually arousing or simply emotionally engrossing or not, you also have that kind of distancing where you go, well, that's some other time, some other place when this could happen.
Yeah, I strongly agree. And, as the works that I mentioned earlier, Tomo no Chinsho and Kesutoki no Uta, are set in these boys' schools. And the way those came about, the two women who did them went to a film together showing in Tokyo in the summer of Roger Perefich, Les Amitiés Particulières, Special Friendships, by a movie made of a book by a French author. And that's what turned them on to actually producing these two products that would become so important in the genre's history. But that was very much a movie about two boys in a French school in the 1940s, I think it was the 20s. It was very easy to take that, as a trope and displace it, as, to use the word Paul did, and then create something out of it.
So in a way, it's an Eastern gaze on a Western situation.
And the other way around, too.
Yeah, that's fascinating. It's all switching back and forth like characters, and that's great. Well, what do you guys work in? Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
There's an element of sort of fantasy projection in a lot of different ways there. Projecting indigenous situations, whether it's in Japan or whether it's here in the West, onto an exotic other, but also projecting the very otherness onto them as well in different ways. So, it can become really complex.
Mm-hmm. They're very, very sophisticated characters, I find. I'm still learning how to read them, but it's fascinating. What are you guys working on now? Paul, you can start.
Paul? I'm expanding from my work on German manga into work on the history of comics in Germany in general, sort of leading up to the situation that allowed manga to sort of conquer Germany so easily. People talk about the manga wave in the West, but although it subsided a bit, manga was never more than about a third of the market in the U.S., whereas manga has dropped from 80% of the German comics market to 60%. Hmm. And people are talking about a bust. It's like, I'm sorry, 60% is hardly a bust.
No.
But because the German comics industry has always been essentially colonized from outside, both in terms of the ownership of most of the major publishers and in terms of the actual material, which has been simply translated and imported, the arrival of Japanese manga was simply another wave of that colonization. Mm. And in preparation for the ebbing of the manga wave, the German publishers have moved to graphic novels.
Mm-hmm.
The German word for graphic novel is graphic novel. So it's just another layer of... there are more indigenous works coming out now, more and more German authors being represented, and I think the manga boom has a good deal to do with that. Because it provided some of the infrastructure and some of the level of confidence to say, yes, we can do this. But it's still a form that's simply being brought in from outside, going, let's try this on for size.
Well, do they have the comic cons and the gatherings like we do here?
They do. They're much smaller compared to even the French versions in the neighboring country. There's a healthy fan scene, certainly for manga and anime. There are three or four major annual events. Some are corporate sponsored and some are fan club sponsored. There's strong small niche markets for other forms of comics, American comic books. There's a Marvel comic fan club, for example, and for nostalgic groups for older German comics. But certainly they're not as active or as showy as the anime and manga groups. But there are also a couple of major comic festivals for comics in general that have been organized, and some of them are now 25, 30 years old in Germany.
And I know you're in Canada. What about in Canada? Are you seeing similar events and things going on there?
We certainly do. We've had Anime North was just up here recently in Toronto, and there's a big fan expo coming up that will certainly have manga and anime as well as other popular culture. But obviously, both because of our geographical location and our relatively small population, there are more Californians than there are Canadians. we're pretty much in the shadow of U.S. culture, which is, sometimes a good thing and sometimes a bad thing. We do sometimes export material. There's some major Canadian comics artists, and even a few well-known Canadian German manga artists.
Oh, wow. You want to put Canadian, a couple
of plugs? Sorry, Canadian manga artists who've published with
in German.
With sadly now defunct Tokyo Pop in the U.S. Although Tokyo Pop also imported a couple of German authors.
Huh.
Didn't say they were German, but published their manga in English as well.
Huh. Mark, what are you up to?
Well, thematically, I'll answer it thematically and then what I have coming up.
Okay.
We're going to work. So thematically, I'm interested in consent. I emailed Paul, actually, a few weeks ago that at the San Antonio PCA, after my paper, I was asked by, I presented a story about a high school boy who adopts a dog and they have who's become loveless because the dog takes on a human form, which, by the way, shape-shifting is a very common theme in Japanese. So one of the questions was, well, what about consent? You know, and, you know, I didn't know how to really answer that. But when I thought about it, you know, the works I mentioned earlier, Tomono Shinsho and Kasetsuki no Uta, are about consent. And that's a theme of a lot of voice love manga, I think. So I'm going to look into it and see if, you know, there will be something there I could write something about. What I have coming up is I have a chapter in a book called Mangatopia. It's to be published in October by Libraries Unlimited. There's a couple articles on voice love in that book. And the other one is two professors and I, Kazumi Nagaki from Oita University, and Drew Pagliasotti and I are going to guest edit a special issue of the Routledge Journal of Graphic Novels and Comics, which the theme will be a voice of manga. So we're in discussions with them about a date, you know, looking at 2013 maybe, and, you know, finishing up the CFP so we can actually put it out there. So I would encourage people to, you know, anybody hearing this who would be interested in contributing to that, you know, to get in touch with us on it.
Great. Have you guys got anything else you'd like to add?
I can't think of anything.
Exhausted the topic pretty well. So.
Other than thanking you for the interview.
My pleasure.
Yeah.
We've been talking with Mark McHarry, who is co-editor with Antonia Levy and Drew Pagliasotti of Boys Love Manga, Essays on the Sexual Ambiguity and Cross-Cultural Fandom of the Genre, published by McFarland Press. With him was Paul Malone, associate professor of German at the University of Waterloo, who contributed an essay on manga in the German market.